Hello, everyone. This is Dave Goulas, president of EasyDC 3PL, and thank you for tuning in to the Beyond Fulfillment podcast, where we spotlight small business owners, entrepreneurs, startup founders, and we have real conversations about their journey, what it's really like, and what they've learned along the way. Thank you and enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of the Beyond Fulfillment podcast. I'm your host, Dave Goulas. And this week, my guest is the founder and the CEO of Zero Caviar, Noah Treisman. Welcome, Noah.
Thanks, Dave.
All right. So, Noah, if you could, can you let everyone know what Zero Caviar is and how it came to be?
Yeah. So Zero Caviar is actually a plant-based caviar. We use agar-agar seaweed extract to create a plant-based alternative to traditional caviar. We're able to achieve a very similar aesthetic and flavor profile as the real thing without any animal products. And we do all the production in Denmark, outside of Copenhagen, from our production facility, our lab testing, and our co-packing as well.
Oh, okay. Okay. And we connected when I met your people at Expo East. And I think you weren't at the booth or whatever, but it was Mackenzie, actually, I met. And yep. She put us together, but I remember, and I've never actually tried caviar, and they were like, oh yeah, try a sample of caviar, and it was like really good. Like I was like, wow, this is tasty. And so I was listening to you on another podcast too, and I guess there's part of how it came to be is there's I think you were going to parties and something like people didn't like the taste. Is that right?
Yeah. So I've had a long and circuitous career that has overlapped between tech, entertainment, and hospitality. And during the sort of onset of the pandemic in LA, there were a lot of restrictions around what you could do socially. And a big part of my business was social media. So what I did was I held some, social distancing responsible dinner parties at my home where I'd invite various chefs in my network, ranging from, Aaron May, to the Canna Queen, to host these really intimate dinner parties. And one of the highlights, at least the highlights in my mind, was the caviar that I would procure. I had a really good relationship with a production facility in China and got it for a really reasonable price. And I thought it was a nice treat, a nice sort of in-home luxury to take people's minds off the pandemic. What I realized pretty quickly was that less and less of the caviar was being eaten. And this is a very perishable product. And it's still expensive, even when you're getting it for a good deal. So I inquired to my guests, was there something wrong with the caviar? And there was nothing wrong with the caviar. It was just the fact that people were becoming more and more conscientious of what they were putting in their body, what they were purchasing. And a lot of people, I think, especially on the heels of the Seaspiracy documentary, What the Health, some of these really informative pieces of, information changed the way that they looked at food. And whether it was a fully plant-based diet, a more responsible, sort of consumer habit, they weren't as interested in caviar as they once were. So I like caviar personally, and I think that it can be a nice treat, on special occasions. But I thought, I wanted to include everybody who is attending these parties in the sort of, centerpiece of the table, if you will. And I reached out to a molecular gastronomist who I met at NOMA in Copenhagen in 2017 and sort of asked him, would this be feasible? If they could make, caviar taste like cacao or, a duck liver flavored mousse, why couldn't they make a caviar flavored pearl? And, a few short months later, we'd done a couple lab tests and we had something that I thought was pretty good.
Wow. So the catalyst for this business came out of, dinner parties and trying to find a better, more sustainable, better tasting caviar.
That's what led to the actual creation of the product. But I actually owned and operated restaurants in New York City and Connecticut for several years prior to the pandemic. And what that led to was ultimately, some insight into the caviar ecosystem and the consumer preferences of even caviar consumers themselves. And what we learned was that the most common complaint about caviar was that it was too fishy and too salty. So I'd always been on the lookout for a milder flavor profile caviar, and it was kind of hard to find. So when this feedback and this opportunity through the dinner parties presented itself, I thought maybe this is what I've been looking for, not a milder, less salty, less fishy caviar, but a plant-based alternative.
Okay. And, you know, like you said, this is in the middle of the pandemic, right, where things were crazy and didn't really know what was going on or what was going to happen. So you have this idea and you have this connection in Denmark. What's it like to turn that into a viable business in that environment?
You know, of the many businesses I've started, some of them very viable, some not so much. This has been the most interesting, and I'd say in many ways the most counterintuitive. You know, I never started Zero with the intent of commercializing it or creating, you know, a monetizable business. You know, CPG is far from my traditional, you know, domain expertise. But I think similar to some of my more successful ventures, it's really been letting the voice of the customer dictate the product roadmap. You know, there were some previous iterations that were a different texture, a different color, a different size, a different flavor profile. And while I think I had a generally strong intuition as to what I wanted and what my friends and ultimately customers wanted, it was listening to the feedback of everybody, not just my vegan friends, not just my vegetarian friends, not just my keto friends, and not just my caviar consumer friends, but really listening to everybody's feedback and making sure that we created a product that was maximally inclusive, not only from a price point, but also from a flavor profile, from a product, from an appeal. And I think that's kind of been the benchmark of our success, the fact that Zero is not limited to a certain subset of the sort of culinary, you know, demographic. It's really something that anybody can enjoy. And we've actually been, I think, really delighted in many ways to see that it is served alongside meat dishes. It is served at non-vegan or non-plant-based establishments. And some of our biggest customers are, you know, flexivores, where they'll eat, you know, just about anything as long as it meets certain, you know, moral, ethical, you know, whatever parameters they have in place for what they put in their body. And I think, you know, if you really focus on your core consumer or really identify what the people want from just a sheer, you know, preference perspective, the money soon follows. And, you know, we've accidentally created, you know, a viable business.
Okay. Has that always been your strategy with your other businesses too? Is like the main focus is what the customer wants and what their feedback is as far as like the roadmap to how the product or the service evolves?
I'd say like the first step of any business that I set out to create is analyzing where there might be a gap in the market to find that product market fit. This was a little bit less strategic and intentional in the early days because it wasn't intended to be a business of its own, a standalone business. But I would say that it's, you know, unintentionally followed in very similar footsteps. You know, there is, I think, at the intersection of fine dining, luxury, and responsible, ethical, and plant-based cuisine, there's a massive opportunity and there's a bit of a void. You know, I think that some of the traditional luxury foods don't offer a very appealing alternative. You know, if you're looking at crab, let's say, or lobster, or, you know, uni, you know, there's just not a lot there. And when I saw that I could create, I think, a very comparable caviar experience with a plant-based offering, I was confident that the demand would be there. You know, the rest of the business kind of fell into place and is still evolving. You know, it's an iterative process. But yeah, I think the common denominator across all my businesses is finding product market fit and really, you know, exploring that before, you know, taking your product, service, platform, whatever it may be, to market.
Okay. And another really interesting thing about Zero is, you know, I've noticed you haven't gone the traditional route that other CPG brands do, meaning getting into, you know, the retailers and going that route. It seems like you went the opposite way, where your main sales channels are like five-star restaurants or Michelin-starred restaurants, and then you do a lot of celebrity and influencer marketing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all part of the unconventional, you know, launch strategy or lack thereof that's led Zero to where it is today. You know, for the first year or so, we weren't, you know, it was really hard to buy. You know, you basically had to find us on Instagram, you know, which became easier and easier as more celebrities started posting on us about us, but you had to DM us. You know, I was managing the Instagram amongst many other businesses that, you know, I was operating and kind of more focused on. And, you know, it was the really persistent, you know, fine dining establishments at first that were able to get us on their menu. And then, you know, some of the influencers, celebrities, you know, getting to us through the DMs, through mutual friends. And it was that sort of like critical mass, that sort of tipping point of attention and inquisition that forced my hand in many ways to think of this as a real business and rather than a passion project. So, you know, our first restaurant customer was Crustacean, who we were introduced to and was introduced to us through a mutual friend. You know, the On family has a long and storied history of, you know, restaurateurs and really creating some really innovative and exceptional fine dining experiences. And without them, I'm not sure any of this would be possible, to be honest, but they were our first real commercial fine dining customer. From there, we were fortunate enough to add Restaurant Danielle. You know, I lived in New York for almost 10 years and only, you know, had the good fortune of scoring a reservation, let alone being able to afford a reservation at Restaurant Danielle once in that 10 years. And it, you know, had a really indelible, you know, impact on my, you know, approach to fine dining or my perspective of it. So, you know, as the momentum grew, so did the attention that I put on it. And, you know, bringing Mackenzie on board as, you know, a co-founder and partner in the business has really been, I think, an inflection point because, you know, she's able to focus on this in a full-time capacity in a way that I never really was. And the results have been immeasurable. You know, not only are we in several other, you know, Michelin-starred restaurants and fine dining establishments across Miami, Los Angeles, New York. We just got on the menu at Le Coup, at the Rubel Museum in Miami, Giselle on the rooftop of 11, also in Miami, a lot of fine dining retailers. So yeah, it's not in any ways conventional, or I think as strategic and maybe systematic as a traditional business launch and go-to-market may be, but it's worked out really well. And sometimes I think it's that organic, you know, evolution that really lends the most credibility to a brand like ours.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And like you mentioned, the inflection point with bringing Mackenzie on, I mean, clearly you're a serial entrepreneur doing a lot of different things. And like you said, you weren't even planning on turning this into a business, and it kind of just evolved while you were doing other things. How important is it to have, like, you know, because it seems like you're more of a visionary and have a lot of ideas and whatnot versus, right, like Mackenzie bringing on like a solid operator that can spend full time type capacity on this. How important is that for an entrepreneur?
It's the most important thing. I mean, people call me, you know, a frantic founder or an ADHD entrepreneur. I'm really good at starting a business. I'm not always the best at scaling it or managing it. You know, the details drag me down. It's the vision that excites me. And, you know, I think it's important to kind of identify how this evolved, not only from a demand perspective, but also a relationship perspective. You know, one of my good friends, named Julian Marshall, you know, a fantastic film director in New York who I've known for many years, introduced me to Barry Nailbuff, the founder of the Honest Tea Company, you know, a very successful entrepreneur and professor. He introduced me then to Jessica Price, you know, who, you know, got the Kellogg MBA, Brown undergrad, spent 10 years at Quaker and PepsiCo, all the bona fides. And then Mackenzie, you know, who had actually a background in tech, sales and marketing, but I think a work ethic, an attention to detail, and the level of motivation that if I wasn't lacking, I certainly wasn't channeling the right way. And the combination of the three of us has certainly been the catalyst that's led to what I'd say, if not an inflection point, near it. And if you don't have complementary skill sets, people and personalities on your founding team, whether that's as co-founders, employees, supporters, mentors, advisors, whatever the case may be, you're probably limited by your own strengths and weaknesses. And I know that whether it's Zero or any of the other ventures, you know, that I've started, the benchmark of their success or failure has ultimately been the people that I surround myself with. Because it's very hard, unless you're an Elon Musk type, which very few of us are, to be a very successful solopreneur. I don't recommend it. And, you know, it's not something that I often am successful doing.
So now you mentioned you got started like in the restaurant business and whatnot. Did you always know you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
If you ask my parents, they would say, yeah. I mean, I don't remember there being like a decision or like a seminal moment where I was like, I want to be an entrepreneur. I mean, you know, I was selling tie-dye t-shirts as a 10-year-old and had a pretty lucrative lemonade stand even before that. So I guess, you know, there's always been a part of me that's motivated by, you know, making money and creating a business. I do find it very exciting. It's something I'm passionate about. You know, I think, you know, it's awesome to be successful as an entrepreneur, but in order to be successful, I think you have to almost relish in the failures as well, you know, recognize how many learnings those experiences can provide you. So, I think that there's a lot of stuff on Instagram and TikTok encouraging everyone to quit their day job and bet on themselves and be an entrepreneur. And, while it's definitely something that I love and I think is right for me, I don't know if it is for everyone. You know, it is very, very stressful at times. It can induce a lot of anxiety. And unless you have the ability to, I think, channel that stress and anxiety into productivity, into work ethic, into, you know, some sort of, you know, positive motivation, then it can be overwhelming and maybe unhealthy. But for me personally, you know, I don't think there's any other way. You know, I'd rather start a business that is unsuccessful with, you know, the chance of creating an impact or building something special than, you know, toiling in a, you know, 9-to-5 or, you know, working at a corporate gig like, you know, I did for a couple of years right after I graduated college. It wasn't for me.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, you touched on something too, right? Like you look at social media and the Instagram stuff, right? A lot of it looks glamorous and you might see the money or the fancy stuff and the quote freedom. But like you said, a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress. And it is, you know, sometimes too, it's just dealing with the voices in your own head, especially with your things aren't going right. Like you mentioned channeling all that into something productive and into, you know, something positive. Yeah, like what? How do you do that? Because clearly, there's had to be some times where you've been challenged in the journey. How do you channel that into something productive?
I'm gonna be honest. You know, my number one recommendation to anybody who is getting started as an entrepreneur is actually don't quit your day job until you've had a liquidity event or some sort of financial success, some sort of exit that can insulate you from the downside of an unsuccessful venture. You know, I worked in health tech for a very long time, working as an early employee of some health tech startups in the EHR, interoperability and population health management space. I was very fortunate to be able to start my entrepreneurial journey as more of side hustles or things I worked on in nights at weekends until they became successful, rather than putting all my eggs in that basket. This advice might be counterintuitive to what you read or see from a lot of the luminary founders of the world, but I really believe that it allowed me, you know, to start the restaurants while I was still doing clinical IT consulting. It gave me a cushion, it gave me a bit of a safety net, and it allowed me to pour myself into my passion projects in the entrepreneurial space without as big of a risk of not being able to pay my rent or, you know, keep my lights on. Not everybody can be that fortunate, and it requires making some sacrifices on a personal perspective. You know, it's not as easy, you know, to start a family or have a dog or buy a house perhaps when, you know, you're leveraging your day job for freedom to do an entrepreneurial endeavor on nights and weekends. But it worked out for me, and, you know, fast forward 10 years, I'm really happy about the way that I did it, the decisions I made, and the end result, you know, that's led me here.
Okay. Wow. And so you started restaurants kind of as like, as on the side while you were doing IT consulting?
Yeah. So I was working in predictive analytics and machine learning as it related to population health management and chronic conditions, mostly diabetic pursuit lists, clients like Mount Sinai, Northwell, United Healthcare. And one of my good friends was interested in dropping out of law school and opening a restaurant in Greenwich, Connecticut. Some of my fondest memories growing up were visiting my family in Chicago and going to these, you know, 20 plus person dinners at dimly lit Italian restaurants. And it's kind of informed my social preference. I've always been a big boozy dinner guy before a nightclub or, you know, party guy. And the opportunity to partner with one of my friends on, you know, creating an experience that I value so much in my own life seemed like something worth doing. And the fact that it was as successful as it was is kind of reminiscent, honestly, of what's happened with Zero. You know, it started as a passion project. Our first location in Greenwich was very successful. It led to several others in the West Village of Manhattan, Huntington Village, Long Island, Stamford, Connecticut, and ultimately the Hamptons. And up until the very end, I was still, you know, making trips to the C-suite of some of the biggest hospitals and health systems in New York, helping them achieve interoperability between their EHR, their diagnostics lab, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff that you wouldn't necessarily associate with truffle cream or ravioli or the glitz and glam of a Sag Harbor 160 seat restaurant.
Wow. Yeah. And like you see some of these restaurants like that, like the Michelin starred ones, right? And I mean, prime location, right? Very expensive real estate, right? Like you see you wouldn't think that the owner of that is working a full-time gig just to basically make that happen. But yeah, that's what you did. So I mean, that seems like a testament too to like whatever it takes.
In fairness, it wasn't full time. You know, I was fortunate enough to have been a part of some early stage exits, you know, in the health tech space, and then parlay that into a consulting career. So being a consultant, I guess, was an entrepreneurial endeavor of itself, but it did allow me the freedom to delegate and dedicate my time as I determined. So again, the advice I'm giving may not work for everyone, but I would strongly recommend that you give yourself some options and that you don't commit 100% necessarily to your entrepreneurial endeavor until you've seen a little bit of traction, because a failed business venture is not the end of the world, but it can be really harmful if you don't have a backup plan or you don't have a contingency. You know, it works for some people, but for me, I think the peace of mind and the stability of at least having something lined up in case your plan A fails is a valuable mechanism to maintain your mental health throughout all the highs and lows of entrepreneurship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the thing, right? The highs can be really high, but the lows can be really low too. So like,
occur within the same day sometimes. So yeah, it's quite a roller coaster.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and then so is that how you? Because obviously, I've seen you've do celebrity and influencer marketing, and you have quite a network there. Is that kind of how you got tapped into that world? Is through the restaurant business?
So I would say, you know, the restaurant business was my first kind of introduction to the IRL, you know, in real life revenue that followings, digital followings, social media followings could have. It fostered some close relationships that have, you know, proved invaluable in future endeavors. And yeah, I think, you know, influencer marketing is a pretty broad term that has, you know, reached a saturation point perhaps as it relates to startups over the last several years. But I think that it's kind of the intersection of user-generated content and celebrity endorsements drives a lot of interest from the general public. And if you're producing a quality product or service, that interest can certainly convert into sales and revenue and customers. So yeah, you know, the restaurants were kind of the first foray. You know, I spent some time collecting and selling art as well, which introduced me to that same sort of rarefied air that the ultra wealthy and famous operate in. And you know, I've made some really good friends and strong relationships along the way that, you know, have also, you know, helped me out on a professional perspective.
Okay. And, you know, you touched on the network there too. For someone starting out or for someone building their, you know, building their brand and starting a venture, how important is network?
I don't think it's terribly important that you have a celebrity network. Most people don't. And I didn't certainly when I was starting off, but I do think that the saying your network is your net worth is more accurate now than ever. But I do think the network extends to everybody, you know, on your team, whether it's sales, marketing, operations, distribution. Having strong relationships with people on every edge of the spectrum when you're starting a business is going to make your chances of success much higher. People are much more likely to do business with their friends than they are a stranger. You know, I have a saying that I do business with all my friends and I'm friends with everyone I do business with. You know, I think, you know, there are times where you can't maintain that decorum or friendliness, you know, especially as the businesses grow and the money gets bigger. But when at all possible, I think, you know, you should look at every potential business partner as a friend and every friend as a potential business partner. And if you look through that lens, I think you'll foster not only really fulfilling relationships, but really productive ones too. And I'm really happy, you know, to call almost all of my business partners my friends and increasingly more of my friends, you know, business partners.
Wow. Yeah, so true, right? Because I find that too, right? Like network and relationships and the people you know and the people that know you as a quality person, as someone that keeps their word and someone that can get results is invaluable as you're trying to scale a business or grow or get into new markets or whatever it may be.
Totally.
Also, I saw you have some other businesses in the past. You had one called Glow. It looks like you maybe had an exit on that. Is that right?
Yeah. So take it from the restaurant. So I sold my restaurants in 2018, most of them at least, to the butcher's daughter, and was doing some health tech stuff, kind of thinking what I was going to do next. How do I leverage my skill and experience as a technologist with this newfound network of celebrities and influencers? The first venture was called Green Ring. It was the first payment processing mechanism that allowed celebrities to subscribe or to, I'm sorry, to allow celebrities to allow their followers to subscribe to their close friend list on Instagram. We had meteoric success right off of the bat, maybe too much success. And within a couple months of us launching, Instagram announced that they were going to be releasing a native feature that allowed celebrities and influencers to charge a subscription to be added to their close friend list. This was a bit of a gut punch, even though it took them 3 years to actually release the feature set. It capped our growth potential, made it somewhat uninvestable from a VC perspective, but it did help me earn some credibility, I think, amongst the influencer and celebrity community. You know, this was in the middle of the pandemic where the social media landscape was rapidly changing. And I think a lot of influencers were looking for management with a more established business acumen than some of the former realtors and nightclub promoters that they'd been employing historically. You know, I parlayed that success with Green Ring into a successful social media management firm. And amongst all my clients, the hottest topic by far was another paywall platform. And this one was called OnlyFans. OnlyFans was, of course, a very stigmatized platform, kind of defined by its corny and porny fixation on adult content. And so what I did was partner with two other guys to create a platform, well, a company called Glow Up Digital with our flagship platform, Dream.me. It was a creator platform that was intended for people who were unhappy with the level of regulation on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook, and how opaque the regulation was. You know, people were getting deplatformed and demonetized at an alarming basis, oftentimes with unclear reasons for what, you know, they had done to flag their account. So we started Dream, to serve everybody, you know, models, comedians, podcasters, political commentators, anybody who felt that they were being censored on the incumbent social media platforms. Dream ended up growing to be the biggest competitor of OnlyFans. It was content agnostic, although we did prohibit some of the really hardcore explicit stuff that OnlyFans allowed. So we fashioned a sort of an upmarket Soho House of OnlyFans, if you will, invitation only for talent, application only for subscribers. And, you know, calling back to the product market fit discussion we had earlier, we found it, and we found it very quickly. The company grew very fast, and 11 months after the formation of the entity, only 8 months after our launch, we were acquired by PLBY Group, the parent company of Playboy, Honey Birdette, Lovers, and Yandy. And definitely a successful exit. You know, you can never complain about an eight-figure exit in less than a year, but not the space I wanted to be in, nor the company I wanted to work for. So I think the greatest thing about that windfall was not the compensation. In fact, it was the freedom that it gave me, you know, to exit from that sort of intersection of social media and exclusive content and focus my time more on my plant-based caviar company, as well as another creator space that I'm really passionate about, which is that intersection of social media and legalized sports betting. So it's been a long journey. At least it feels like a long journey in a relatively short amount of time. And I feel very fortunate, like I said, to have been able to have success in all these different spaces, but also maintain my freedom, not having to go work for a corporate content company like Playboy and be an indentured servant with restrictive covenants, all that good stuff. So, that's what has allowed me now, you know, to have the career flexibility that I currently maintain.
Wow. Yeah. What a story, right? I mean, you get this great idea, you start the company, and you get acquired at a very attractive exit 8 months in. I mean, that's phenomenal, right? It doesn't get much better than that.
It would be a little bit better if Playboy stock hadn't gone down 95%, but I was able to squeeze a little bit out, luckily, before the economy took so much away.
Yeah, and just hearing you speak too, clearly you're well educated. You have an excellent understanding of business and whatnot. Where does that come from? Have you always just been basically a student of business as you've been doing all these things?
I don't know. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. Both my parents are therapists. I think my entrepreneurial gene comes from my mom and my gramps, her dad, my grandpa. Came over from Prague when he was a little boy fleeing the Holocaust and had a very successful career as a self-made man, you know, living the American dream. My mom has been very successful, kind of creating her own industry. You know, she's a thanatologist, who specializes in grief counseling and actually was the first person to offer those sort of services to people whose pets had passed away. A lot of people, you know, laugh when they hear that, but it's actually a pretty big deal. You know, for a lot of people, their pets are an extension of their family. And before her, there wasn't a lot of offerings for people who are suffering, you know, upon the passing of a pet. Now, almost every city in America has somebody who does what she does. She travels the country and even the world, speaking at conferences, on TV shows. So, you know, not, again, a conventional entrepreneur, you know, in the typical sense, but I think that my entrepreneurial spirit was probably one half nature, you know, being the son and the grandson of my mom and my grandpa, and one part nurture. You know, I've been fortunate to be exposed to some pretty successful entrepreneurs throughout my life. Again, I don't remember that seminal moment where something ticked and I said, that's what I want to do. But, you know, one of the blessings and the curses of ADD, which I am self-diagnosing myself with, is that it's really hard to focus on things you're not interested in. And it's really easy to focus on things that you are interested in. So when I've found things throughout my life that pique my interest and pique my passion, it's very hard to get in the way of me and my vision or, you know, my aspirations. And for better or worse, that's led me down, you know, a lot of paths over the course of my life and the course of my career. But it's a lot of people do ask me, you know, how does a son of two hippies from Portland, Oregon end up, you know, in the places I've been? And the honest answer is I'm not entirely sure still.
Well, like you said, that's so important too. The point of, like, you know, everyone learns differently, and whether it's ADHD or any one of a number of different things, right? People don't always learn the same way. So sometimes maybe people aren't great students, but, you know, they have an interest or a passion or a knack for something, and they just learn differently. And that's a testament to it's, you know, if you can focus on what you're interested in and provide value and parlay that into, you know, helping others, you know, sky's the limit.
I agree 100%.
Another interesting thing I saw on your profile, and this has got to be probably one of the cool parts of doing what you've done and some successful exits. So you are part owner of the Brooklyn Aces pickleball team.
That I am. And my birthday is actually tomorrow. And one of the first presents I received, my laptop sitting on top of, it's a very fancy pickleball paddle holder. When I sold my company in October of 2021, at the time, one of the best parts of it was that it was a tax-exempt reorganization, an all-stock deal. I had a short window where I could relocate to a city or state where the taxes wouldn't be as punitive as they were in LA, where I was based at the time. And I packed up the car and drove 18 hours nonstop to Austin, Texas. Took a nap after 18 hours, did the next four with a little bit more rest. But when I moved to Austin, one of the first things that I picked up was pickleball. I am obsessed. I'm addicted. I can't play one game. I was playing, if you look at my Instagram, I don't post a lot, but what it mostly is playing pickleball, as I was, you know, till about 10:30 last night. I love the sport. I, you know, grew up playing ping pong with my dad in the basement almost every night, very competitively. And pickleball, I think, takes some of the best parts of both ping pong and tennis and merges them into one really accessible and exciting sport, fast paced, fun. And yeah, I was traveling, you know, after the exit. I took a little bit of time to travel for the first time in many years, partially due to work, partially due to the pandemic. And one of the new fast friends that I made in Austin was my friend Darius, who I was traveling through Europe with. And all I could talk about was this Major League Pickleball League. And the founder, Steve Kuhn, was in our pickleball league in Austin, the one that Darius hosted at his office in Millbrook Estate. And I was relentless in telling him that I knew he would probably get an opportunity to buy into a team and that I wanted an opportunity to buy into a team. And 6 months after that fateful trip, I got, you know, one of the most exciting calls of my career, believe it or not, which was Darius telling me that we'd been approved to join the ownership group of not just any team, but the Brooklyn Aces, the best pickleball team by any measurement. The co-ownership's pretty damn cool. You know, we have Drake, the rapper, we have Michael B. Jordan, one of my favorite actors, Steve Stout, a luminary businessman, Kevin Durant. I'm a Portland Trailblazers fan, so, you know, Kevin's great, but, you know, I would have rather had Damian Lillard, I guess. Rich Kleiman, another, you know, luminary, you know, tech and entertainment executive. So, you know, I'd be lying if I said I have a major hand in day-to-day operations and ownership of the Brooklyn Aces, but it is really fun to be such, you know, a integral part of such a fast-growing sport, such an exciting team, such a small, intimate ownership group relative to the other franchises. And I think at this point in my career, I can say that, you know, based on the markups that we're seeing on the value of each of these teams, this may be the best investment I've ever made. Second, probably only to, you know, Bitcoin, you know, back in 2014. So I love pickleball. I love being a part of the sport, and I'm super excited to see it continue to gain traction, not only in America, but across the globe.
Wow. Yeah. That's a cool story too, especially because it's like, it came out of such a passion for just the sport, and loving to play and wanting to play every day. And then, you know, it turned into such a cool opportunity where premier team and a lot of celebrities and great investment.
I love it, man. Yeah. And anybody who hasn't played pickleball, I challenge you to play one time, because the first day I picked up a paddle, the first game I played, I was on the court for 4.5 hours, played nearly 15 games. It's really, I call it the backgammon of paddle sports. Very easy to learn, very hard to master. And backgammon's probably my second favorite pastime. So, you know, it was kind of a match made in heaven. And evidently not just for me, because, you know, if you look at the numbers, I don't think we've ever seen a sport grow in popularity, not only, you know, from people playing, but also people watching. You know, there was a data point that was really encouraging last year during the NHL and NBA playoffs. There was a pickleball match nationally televised, a hockey playoff game, an NBA playoff game, and the pickleball match outperformed all of them in ratings and viewership. Now, the caveat is that, you know, Andre Agassi, John McEnroe, you know, some legendary tennis players were playing in that match. But again, you know, I think it's still indicative of the phenomenon, you know, kind of unprecedented in the world of sports and entertainment that pickleball, you know, has captured. This is truly lightning in a bottle. And I think it's here to stay.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you said, the success and how quick it's grown and the interest, and then the celebrities get involved, all that makes for success.
For sure. I agree.
So you've had the successful career as an entrepreneur, you've had some exits, you're growing a new company. What are you most excited about coming up in this next year?
I think two things for sure. One, and I'm not counting pickleball, because if I'm being honest, I spend an hour or two a month, you know, actively involved in operations, not even probably. I'm much more of a enthusiastic owner than an, you know, operational owner. I'm really excited about Zero. Expo East was an immeasurable success. The validation, I think, by seeing not only, you know, fine dining and Michelin starred and celebrity customers enjoying our product, but seeing such a diverse array of people and personalities, not only understanding and appreciating, but really embracing the product and showing such authentic engagement and interest, reinforced my conviction that this is something that can be appealing to more than just a niche the way that traditional caviar is. We also have a lot of exciting plans and partnerships. Mackenzie and Jess are really on top of things. We've been learning so much from Jess and her network, you know, Barry Nailbuff, Spike Mendelson, Aaron May, who's been a supporter since literally day one. And I don't want to jinx anything, but I think after 2 years of kind of toiling in relative obscurity, maybe not giving the company the attention and resources it deserved, 2024 is going to be the year of zero. You know, I think you're going to see it at a lot more restaurants, on a lot more menus, and really available to purchase at a lot more places. So I'm excited to see how that goes. And then I think, you know, my other company, you know, winnable.com, you know, monetizing the sort of intersection of sports betting and social media. I played sports all through high school. I am a very passionate sports fan outside of just pickleball. I love football. I love the NBA. I love collegiate athletics. And I think that the ability to now legally wager on those games, whether it's peer-to-peer in a friendly way or against the sports book, has created a lot of opportunities for entrepreneurship in the creator space. You know, I've had most of my success making and managing creator economies. And I think the next big one is this intersection of sports betting and social media. And with the platform that myself and my co-founders, you know, some brilliant Stanford University computer science and AI engineers have built over the past year, we're unlocking the opportunity for these sports betting influencers to finally monetize their extremely large, engaged, and valuable audiences, whether through affiliate deals or subscription-based sales. These are guys and girls who are extremely passionate, extremely knowledgeable, and very hardworking. And now that, you know, there's a way for them to monetize everything that they've built over the past few years, I'm excited, you know, to play an active role in unleashing that earning potential. I think that creators are not given the respect oftentimes they deserve or the resources that they should command. And I don't think there's been an industry since cannabis in 2014 that has been as lucrative and generated so much cash and jobs and opportunity as sports betting does. And you know, I'm really excited to bring those resources to this growing creator class and seeing, you know, what exciting stuff they do with it.
Okay. And then is that scheduled to launch next year?
So we launched MVP last year, actually. It was very successful. And that MVP allowed us to raise some money from a very strategic group of investors, mostly unicorn founders or co-founders, you know, people who I really trust and respect and whose presence on our cap table conveys a lot of credibility. People who, if they're watching, I will certainly be sending them a pitch deck for zero pretty soon here. And using that bit of funding that we raised last year, we created an alpha, you know, a more intentional feature set driven platform dedicated to the sports betting influencer. And it's currently in a sort of closed beta environment, application only. Now I've got about 50 creators on there, about 17,000 active user counts and hundreds of thousands of unique site visits per day. And, you know, similar to zero, you know, I'm probably more of the visionary, you know, the founder with, you know, the sales skills and the marketing and the partnerships and the enthusiasm. But it's really my co-founders, Teddy Young-Grice and Brandon Garcia, you know, Forbes 30 under 30, you know, sold his company Mira AI, for, you know, eight figures before AI was even cool. You know, they're the ones who deserve a lot of the credit here because, you know, the idea is not even half the battle. It's the execution. And they've really executed over the past year. You know, it's been a tough landscape to navigate from a regulatory perspective, a tough product to build from a technical perspective. And I'm really grateful, you know, to be surrounded by such brilliant engineers and product guys, you know, to help take it to where it is. And to also, you know, to allow me to divide my time, you know, between zero and Winnable, you know, which is a luxury very few founders have.
Yeah. And I mean, that's so important too. And clearly you have phenomenal people skills to have all these relationships and to be able to connect with the right people that can.
You caught me on a good day, but I'm always a work in progress. You know, I can be Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sometimes, at least so I've been told, but you know, I definitely think, you know, I turn 36 tomorrow. Hopefully a little maturity has come with that age and experience. And I definitely do my best, you know, to surround myself with the right people, you know, in my personal life and professionally.
Excellent. Okay. And if people want to get a hold of you or connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah. Best way, text me if you have my number. If you don't, it's Noah, like Noah's Ark, N-O-A-H, at zerocaviar.com. That's Z-E-R-O-E caviar.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at zerocaviar.com. Oh, what? No, at zerocaviar, no.com for Instagram. Same thing on TikTok. If you DM us on Instagram, Mackenzie or I or Jess or somebody on the team will likely get your message and forward it along. But you know, feel free to send me an email. You know, maybe put the name of the podcast in the subject so I know to get to it quickly. But you know, we love to hear from our customers. We love to hear from, you know, our distributors. We love to hear from our retailers and restaurants and people who would like to become one. So please reach out. I would love to hear from you.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks everyone for watching. Again, with Noah Treisman of Zero Caviar, and we will see you next time. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
Hello again. Dave Goulas here. Thank you for tuning in to the Beyond Fulfillment podcast. If you like what you heard on today's episode and you got value from it, please click the link below to subscribe so you'll be notified of future episodes when they drop. If you would like to be a guest on a future show, you can also click the link below, or you can email us at info@beyondfulfillmentpodcast.com. That's info@beyondfulfillmentpodcast.com. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.